My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She doesn't have to
welcome
say
to After Hours with me, Rick Cogan. I'm playing Joan Baez sings Bob Dylan because it seems kind of 1968-ish. And I know it's Easter. Happy Easter to those of you who celebrate. One of my favorite writers has long been, God, it's almost pushing two decades now, Robert Kersen. I was a great admirer of his when he wrote for the Chicago Sun-Times, then when he started writing for magazines, and then especially when he started writing a bookshelf of nonfiction books that are among the best nonfiction books ever published over the last two decades. Rob, how are you?
I'm great, Rick. Thanks so much for having
That's
me.
That's too much praise for you, or what? You can live with that.
I'll live with it.
Yeah, okay. Okay. But you know that's true. I mean, you do know that's true. His latest book is his best book, Rocket Man. I think it's also your most ambitious. The subtitle is The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. When I first saw the book and heard about it before I saw it, I realized, my God, Apollo 8 is in the Museum of Science and Industry. I mean, this I know. That was all I could yes. remember or know. That must have been, in part, one of your motivations for this thing.
Yeah, it wasn't just my motivation. It's how I discovered the story myself, because I had taken some friends to see the U-boat, the U-505.
Sure.
Which is an exact match for the one I wrote about in my first book, Shadow Divers. So I was there showing people around, and on the way out, I basically stumbled across this space capsule. And I looked, and it said Apollo 8. And like many people, you know, I was familiar with Apollo 11, which is the first moon landing, and with Apollo 13, where there was an explosion near the moon, and the crew almost didn't make it back. But Apollo 8 seemed strange to me in that I didn't know much about it.
You too. You had that same reaction.
Exactly the same reaction. But when I got home, I started to read about it. And one of the first things I discovered was Neil Armstrong talking about Apollo 8 and saying that this was really, truly the most dangerous and daring and important mission, perhaps, that NASA had ever
run. Certainly bring that home. And also, the fact that it took place just before Christmas in 1968, the backdrop is one of, you know, American chaos. Before we talk about the book, and I'm going to devote a half hour to talking about the book, because the astronauts were Time Magazine's Men of the Year. It just, there's so many astonishing, something that has ever characterized your work, Robert Kersen, is your effective narrative writing, but also your attention to detail and your ability to bring details into everything. You started your career as a lawyer at Harvard. You must be getting sick of talking about this. I find it as interesting as if you walked out fully formed from Lake Michigan and started writing best-selling books. Why did you go to law school?
I went to law school because at the end of my college career at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, I didn't know what else to do. And at the time, lawyers were making a lot more money than they had in previous years. And it seemed this is a way to invest 3 years of your time, not nearly as much time or money as medical school might require. And you could have a really, what I thought would be an interesting and creative career. People told me, you like to argue, you like to think, so law school is perfect for you. Go do it, and then go make a lot of money. And because I had no idea what else to do, I threw out some applications, and I was lucky enough to get into Harvard. I had no idea what lawyers really did. I had none in my family. I didn't know any. And I kind of thought that was the time when L.A. Law was so popular on TV. I thought, well, it's going to be like L.A.
Fun.
Law.
Yeah, that looks fun.
It was very glamorous. They had a different crazy case every week. Yeah, I could do that. I had no idea what I was getting myself into or for the misery that lay ahead.
Did you enjoy law school, though? There are some elements of law school, and I've known a lot of people who have been to law school and wound up being reporters and writers. I certainly did not go to law school, but there are a lot of tools that you obviously couldn't realize, ooh, this would be a good tool when I become a writer. But there's some things about law school that had to be intellectually stimulating, yes?
There were. And being at Harvard Law School, you were in awe of the intellectual horsepower all around you.
Sure.
Not just the professors, but, of course, the students. These were some of the smartest people in the world. It was very intimidating and very difficult to deal with because I certainly felt like the dumbest person in the room wherever I went. I did love the intellectual rigor there and the fact that they made you think logically. So that would end up much later helping me as a writer because
sure.
making an argument, which they insisted you do beautifully there, is very much the same as making presenting a story. You know,
yeah.
one thing follows
yeah.
from the other. But aside from that, there was almost nothing I liked about Harvard Law School.
You felt compelled out of Harvard Law School to get a job where you would make this money that you had just spent going to law school.
Absolutely, because I just spent over $100,000 to be there in 3 years of my life. And even though I did not like the classes and predicted that I would dislike the work very much, I had to at least see what it was all about. And it was every bit as terrible as I expected.
What kind of law did you practice?
It was big firm corporate and real estate law. And I just could not make myself care about Corporation A versus Corporation B. I just had no passion for the thing. And what was required, the dotting of every I and crossing of every T just grinded against my DNA.
Mm.
And I thought, I admire and respect people who can do this. And,
sure.
But it just wasn't
but you're
me.
Not, you're no, not one of them.
It wasn't.
When did you start looking for something else to do? Or did you feel a calling to do something else?
No, I felt no calling, and that was part of what was
yeah,
so depressing
sure,
at the time.
Frustrating.
It was terribly. I felt terribly hopeless because I had no idea what else to do, and I was suffering so badly every day. And it wasn't just that I disliked the work so much. I was so bad at it, too, which is a terrible combination when you're looking at the next 50 years of your life.
Yeah.
So I had no idea what to do, so almost as a defense mechanism at night, I started to write stories for myself. I'd never written a thing in my life, ever, for anything, but I started to write stories about my childhood, and they were all about times where I felt free and hopeful. Sometimes it might just be a story about going on the swings at the playground and pushing as hard as I could to get as high as I could.
Kind of like self-psychoanalysis.
It was.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it at the time, but I was trying to help myself. But what happened as a byproduct of this was that I noticed two things. First, that the writing went by very quickly. So I may have thought, boy, I just wrote a story in 20 minutes and it had been 2.5 hours.
Oh, interesting.
But the next morning, invariably, I would read the stories back and think, I think this is pretty good. It was much better work than I was doing at the law firm.
Wow.
And I thought, I love this and I think it's decent. And so that started to suggest to me, maybe I need to go.
Well, you started in the, as I well remember, you started at about the lowest rung one could ever imagine in the business, except for delivering newspapers, about the lowest rung. We will continue on with Robert Kersen, the author of 4 magnificent nonfiction books. We're going to, Rocket Man being the latest, which you can pre-order now, and if you pre-order it, you get a piece of the moon.
Yes, a small lunar sample, a real piece of the moon for anyone who pre-orders before Tuesday when the book goes on sale.
Just go to Robert Kersen. That's Robert, K-U-R-S-O-N, and we will be back in 3 minutes. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan, Robert Kersen, and his lovely family, which is wife Amy, sons Nate and Will. I'm not going to make them talk and say, I think it's a great, but though I'm sure all three of them thinks that Rocket Man is the greatest book published in the last 3 or 4 years. Robert Kersen, stop being a lawyer and to got a job in the lowest rung of the Sun-Times sports department doing Agate, and then you began to write stories for the paper. It was a, if not welcoming, at least it was a very nurturing, and there was a good crowd there. What year was that?
I got there in 1994.
Okay, it was a nurture. I mean, there were a lot of nice people who I know were there, but it was a nurturing kind of place. I mean, you were living, in essence, your dream at one tenth of your former salary, I would suppose.
One tenth might be generous, but
yeah.
it was heaven from the moment I walked in the building and got into the elevator. Cup was standing next to me.
Oh.
Irv Cup's in that. I couldn't believe it. And when I got to the sports department, you know, my first day, all I did was answer the phones and take high school football scores. But instead of people wearing suits and wingtips and sitting at desks, they were throwing around a Nerf football.
Yeah.
Everybody was wearing sneakers. And someone threw the ball to me, and I thought, I'm never leaving here. I'm going to do everything I can never to leave.
I'm part of the team.
Yeah, part of the team.
I'm part of the team. Then you started writing for Chicago Magazine.
Yes.
Because you were stretching your wings, you obviously felt pretty comfortable writing for the showcase section at the Sun-Times. and you wanted to spread your wings a little?
Yeah, I mean, I was thrilling to write on Deadline for the Sun-Times. I became the rock music critic for several months and wrote features. But everything was on Deadline, and our advantage over the Tribune at the time was we could publish the next day a review.
Right, and sometimes Tribune could not. No, we never did. No, in that era, there was no overnight Deadline thing.
Right.
Now, with the advent of everything being online,
exactly,
the reviews are out. Then you started writing for magazines.
Yes, because as much as I loved the daily writing, you literally would see your stories blowing down the L tracks the next day.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you had a shelf life of a few hours, maybe.
That's right.
And the idea that you might publish something that people would keep around in a doctor's office or waiting room somewhere for a whole month seemed too good to be true. So that became my next dream, and I that's what I did. I went to Chicago and also to Esquire.
Well, you're my favorite teacher piece, which I recall famously, so famously that I reread it today. Was that your first Esquire piece?
It was not only my first Esquire piece, it was my first magazine piece.
See, that's an amazing thing. It also won a National Magazine Writing Award. I'm not going to read the whole 28 pages to you people, but I do want to read. This gives just a taste of Robert Curson's effectiveness as a writer. I'm going to read the beginning of this piece to you, and you tell me, ladies and gentlemen, if you could possibly stop reading this story. One night 20 years ago, my biology teacher picked up a 17-year-old hitchhiker named Jeffrey Wellesley. Hitchhikers are rare on Chicago's exclusive North Shore, where kids owned Camaros and carried plenty of taxi cash. Even rarer were high school teachers who picked them up. It was midnight. Mr. Lindwall pulled over his yellow Toyota Land Cruiser and told... I missed a little thing here. He shut off the headlights, exited the vehicle, and popped open the back hatch. Among a pile of tools, he found his hunting knife, which he unsheathed and poked at Wesley's back. He ordered the boy to bend over and locate the hangman's noose at his feet. Wesley found it and tightened it around his neck the way Mr. Lindwall instructed. My teacher climbed back into the driver's seat and explained. The seat belts in this Jeep didn't unfasten. Put your head between your legs. I'm going to tape your hands behind your back. This noose is attached to a series of pulleys. If you struggle, I can pull tight from here and control you. Wesley now had good reason to believe he'd be killed. The son of a Chicago cop, he'd heard his share of stories. And in those stories, kids wearing nooses didn't live. Then he goes on, just a couple more paragraphs. Recently, I wrote a letter to Mr. Lindwall. It's been 20 years since we've seen each other, I said, but I remember you. I'd like to visit, to catch up and talk about our lives. What I didn't tell Mr. Lindwall was that I'd never stopped thinking about him. While his name had become a sick punchline to anyone who had known him, I still admired him, and I needed to figure out why. Okay, tell me you could possibly stop reading that story. I read the whole thing today, and it's relatively easily accessible when you go to Rob's site to buy his books, robertcurson.com. You did that for a time and wrote some stunning magazine pieces. The idea for your first book... has ever intrigued me. Your first book was Shadow Divers, about two astonishingly interesting characters. How did that book come to be?
I had a friend who called me and said, you need to turn on PBS Nova. There's a two-hour documentary about these two recreational scuba divers who go scuba diving for fun on the weekends who found, sunk in 230 feet of water just 60 miles off the New Jersey coast, a World War II German U-boat with 56 dead German sailors inside, and they'd spent years trying to figure out which U-boat it was, who these men were, and what it was doing in New Jersey. And I had a thought to myself. I remember thinking, I wonder if there are three subjects I could be possibly less interested in than World War II, German naval warfare, scuba diving, and New Jersey. Yeah. But I went and turned it on, and I was fascinated. It was a beautifully done documentary. I think they called it Hitler's Lost Sub, and it was fascinating and beautifully done. But as I watched it, I kept waiting for the narrators to explain why these two scuba divers would risk so much. People were dying around them. Their friends were dying.
Yeah.
They were going broke. They were losing their marriages. Everything was coming apart, and yet they wouldn't give up on this quest to find a three-digit number. I mean, it wasn't going to change anything truly important in the history books, but they were willing to die for this mystery. And I kept waiting for them to explain, why are they willing to die for this? And when the credits started to roll, I thought, that's one of the best documentaries I've ever seen, and they didn't answer the primary question that I had. So what I did was I went into my little office at home, I looked up the name of one of the divers, John Chatterton, and I called him in New Jersey, even as the credits were still rolling, and said, this was a great film I just saw, but they didn't answer the most important questions. And he said, do you like to ride motorcycles? I said, I do. My dad was in the motorcycle paint and lubricant business. That was our family business. And he said, do you like to grill? I said, absolutely. He said, come out on Saturday and we'll talk. And that's how it started.
Wow. Those were two fascinating guys. Complicated.
Very complicated.
Complicated characters. And what so impressed me about that book, which is a great book, Shadow Divers, is the way, and I think years ago we talked about how a writer attempts to form a relationship with a source, and these guys were astonishingly difficult characters, but the book was a bestseller and raves galore, and you found your footing as a nonfiction narrative writer right away, I think, with that book. The next one, Crashing Through, was about, I don't know, 3 years later, 2007 maybe it was published. What's that about?
Crashing Through is the story of only the 16th person in known to history to gain vision after a lifetime of blindness. And you'd think that such a rare thing and such a wonderful thing could be the most beautiful thing that could ever happen to a human being. Imagine never seeing anything, and then one day you open your eyes and you see your children.
Yeah.
Or you see the moon.
Or you see the color blue.
The color blue. Yeah. How thrilling. And you couldn't imagine anything better. And in fact, in the first 15 cases, it was the single worst thing that could have happened to a human being for very interesting and complex psychological reasons. But the 16th person, a man named Mike May, who was living in Davis, California, was the only person alive who could describe what had happened. And when I called him on the phone and expected him to tell me how terrible it had been, just like his 15 predecessors, going back to the year 600 or whatever it was, he told me a very different story, an incredibly fascinating and complicated story, and one that I never expected to hear.
That, too, is a great book. Pirate Hunters in 2015, 14, something like
15,
that.
Yeah.
2015 resurrects one of the characters from that first book, who is searching for pirates and treasure and stuff.
Yeah, he's a character who needs to push himself to do great things, almost impossible things. And he'd accomplished everything you really could accomplish in diving. He'd been to the Titanic. He'd dived the Andrea Doria numerous times, the many other great wrecks, famous wrecks. But he decided really to go after probably the single hardest ship you could ever look for in the world, and that is a Golden Age pirate ship. Only one had been found ever and identified up till a few years ago. And he and a partner kind of got clued in to where another one might be, but not just an ordinary pirate ship, but maybe the greatest pirate ship that had ever sailed, with a very complex and interesting captain who was very much like these two guys who went looking for him.
What Rob Kirson has just told you is enough material to spend the next, if you read fast, the next few weeks reading. We are about, and all of these books, you really should, don't go to Amazon and pre-order this. Go to Robert Kirson, maybe you get to Amazon through Robert Kirson, but go there and pre-order it and get a piece of the moon. But also consider having a similar bookshelf that I have in my house with all of his books. It's only four of them now, for goodness sake. And I cannot tell you the level of enjoyment you will get out of these. We're going to discuss after the news everything there is to know about Rocket Men, the daring odyssey of Apollo 8 and the astronauts who made man's first journey to the moon. Like many of you, Rob Kirson and I came upon Apollo 8 wandering through the Museum of Science and Industry. Idiot that I am, I didn't say, hey, I wonder what the story is behind this. Maybe I could write a book. Rob Kirson, much smarter than I, did say that, and the book is magnificent. It's set, much of it is set in 1968, one of the most tumultuous years in the history of this planet and this city and this country. So we'll be back after the news. First, I'll tell you to make the most out of life after 50 with Prime Expo, the premier event for active adults on April 14th. Learn more at primeexpochicago.com. Also, you can make the most of life after 50 by ordering these books and reading these books. How do you think the show's going so far, Kirsten family? Liking it? Well, the kids are still awake. That's always that's always a good sign on a Sunday night. It's great to have you all in here. I'm a great admirer of your dad's.
You must leave now. Take what you need. You think will last.
That's Joan Baez singing the works of her former boyfriend, Bob Dylan, because it, like, recalls the 60s for me. Rob Kirsten is going to have Thursday night at the Museum of Science and Industry is arguably the coolest book party of the year 2018. You can't go because it's sold out, but Rob will be there. It's the sort of official release of his new book, Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. He will be there. The crew of Apollo 8, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders will also be there. And the Apollo 8 capsule that inspired Rob to write this book will also be there. You know, you should maybe polish that thing or something as a way of thanking that thing for inspiring you. You were inspired. You saw it. You didn't know, as I didn't know much about it, started doing some research. Did you immediately discover that near where you live in the north suburbs, there was a restaurant called Lovell's? And could that possibly be Jim Lovell's restaurant?
Yeah. I should say, by the way, that the museum has put some extra tickets on sale for a simulcast in a theater inside the museum. So if people want to go and be near the capsule and the astronauts, you could still go and have a simulcast in a theater.
This is, I will frankly say, having been to a million book parties, it sounds like the coolest book party ever. It really does.
Yeah. I had been to Lovell's restaurant. It was phenomenal.
I've been there too.
Yeah,
sure.
It's not there anymore. Although Jay Lovell has a new restaurant.
That's right.
That's spectacular. In the Highwood. But in any case, yeah, I knew Jim Lovell, but I knew him mostly through Apollo 13.
Yeah.
And the film, where Tom Hanks plays Jim Lovell.
Of course.
And I knew that Lovell had had other missions, including Gemini missions, but I just didn't know very much about Apollo 8, especially. But boy, when you start to read about it, and when you start to hear and see what other astronauts say about Apollo 8, you know that it's something singular and very special.
One of the things that made it so special was this is a part of, at the height of what we used to refer to and no longer do, as the space race. There was, at one point, a huge competition between the Soviet Union and the United States to land a man on the moon. This was it's hard to describe now. You do it incredibly well in the book, but maybe we're jaded now, you know, given who runs both countries, justifiably so, but beside that.
Yes, the space race, it was really an existential battle because there were huge military implications to who controlled space. There still are, by the way.
Oh, yeah, of course.
But the Soviet Union was our mortal enemy, and we could not afford to let them win the space race. And part of what was going to measure, a big part of what was going to measure the winner of the space race was who sent men to the moon first. Not just landed men on the moon, but who got men to the moon first.
Yep.
Because that was so technologically difficult, almost impossible, that the first of the superpowers that could do that really would have won the space race.
And this is a race. I mean, the trip in 1968 is kind of the manifestation of the dream of John Fitzgerald Kennedy when he was in the White House. So what you're dealing with here is a Kennedy legacy in the same year that his brother is attempting to run for president of the United States and is assassinated. There is so much going on here. It wasn't purposefully made to be a kind of triumphant end to an unbelievably messy year. I mean, we could talk about 1968 forever, but you concentrate on a few elements here.
Yes, it was one of the most terrible and fractious years in our history. And it seemed at the end of 1968 that we could not be more divided as a country. There are a lot of echoes to 2018, by the way.
No question. No question.
It's very, very similar. It rings a lot of bells. But it just seemed everybody was divided against everybody else in 1968. And at the very end, it seemed that there was nothing that could bring this country together again. Everybody distrusted everybody else, young versus old, Republican and Democrat, rural and city. It just seemed hopeless here. And here were these three guys at the very, very end who were going to go to the moon at the very end of 1968 when they launched. Time magazine had already decided on the dissenter as its man of the year.
Wow.
But that was not who they were going to choose by the time Apollo 8 got back.
Came back.
But it was, that's the kind of year it was, that all it represented was violence and strife. In Chicago, we had more than our share of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that's the kind of year it was.
Well, they left, I think, if memory serves, and I just read the book this week, on December 21st and came back, I think, on the 27th.
Exactly right.
One of the things, as I told you and Amy and Nate and Will when you guys came in, is like time skewed. I'm reading the book going, wait a minute, it took almost 3 days to get there?
Right.
Are you kidding me? And then, you know, they orbited maybe 10 times.
Yes.
What also impressed me about this, Robert Kersen, about Rocket Men is the danger of this, which I didn't recall, because I guess because I saw it on television when I was 16, 17 years old, and did not realize, and only realized in reading Rocket Men, this was an unbelievably risky venture.
It's almost impossible to believe when you find out for the first time what kind of risks they were undertaking. This mission was rushed to the launch pad in 4 months. Normally, it took NASA 12 to 18 months to plan and execute a space mission. This was done in 4 months. And the reason it was rushed was twofold. One, well, really, the lunar lander, the spidery landing craft that landing missions would use was not ready, and it was slowing down the whole Apollo program. And it threatened to ruin President Kennedy's promise, the one you referred to that he made in 1961 to land a man on the moon by the end of the decade.
Yeah.
So the president's deadline was suddenly in jeopardy. But maybe even worse than that, top secret intelligence came in indicating that the Soviets looked ready to send a man to the moon by the end of 1968. Not land, but get a man there. And that was everything. So there was NASA and a manager there named George Lowe had an epiphany in around August of 1968. At least that's when he finalized it. That if they sent a mission to the moon without a lunar lander, just to orbit, they could prove so much of the techniques and the equipment and the software and everything else, the trajectories that were required for a lunar landing, without actually landing.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't stall the program. It would keep the program moving. But there were huge risks in doing it that fast. The first of which was that they were going to fly the Saturn V, the mighty Saturn V rocket, the only rocket powerful enough to deliver men to the moon. But the Saturn V in August of 1968 had only been flown twice, both times unmanned, and in its second test, it had failed catastrophically. So then,
I just want to read the first paragraph of the book. Three astronauts are strapped into a small spacecraft 36 stories in the air, awaiting the final moments of countdown. They sit atop the most powerful machine ever built. That's a great lead, as we used to say in the newspaper business.
You.
That is just a great lead.
It's still the most powerful machine ever built, if you can believe it 50 years later.
Well, I thought my phone was the most powerful machine ever built. The three gentlemen who took this flight were kids, basically. They were not, you think of astronauts, they were young men. They were adventuresome, yes?
They were
and they were trained to do this, and they were sort of the right stuff.
They were absolutely the right stuff. They were test pilots and fighter pilots, all from the military, incredibly brave. But if you ask them about bravery, they would tell you, guys were dying in Vietnam every day, and they felt privileged to be doing this, and that the people they believed were making the true sacrifices and undertaking the real risks were the guys in Vietnam.
No, you certainly bring that home. And this was the year of the Tet Offensive. This was. You think chaos was happening in the streets of Chicago? It was brutality and you know, apocalypse in Vietnam. We got to take a little break. I'm going to talk to Rob Kirshen some more about Rocket Man and how he, I don't know if it's winning the trust of, but you got incredible access to the three men, their wives, and as far as I know, if I'm trying to recall everything I absorbed in 2 days of reading, these are the only three astronauts who are still married to the same women that they were married to long ago,
That's right? Absolutely right.
That's got to be a very divorce-prone
yes.
business, being an astronaut. We'll take a little commercial break and come back with Robert Kirshen. That's the website, too, robertkurson.com. Order the book, order all four of his books, and grab a piece of the moon in the process. We'll be right back. That is a voice of Joan Baez singing the songs written by her one-time boyfriend, Bob Dylan. It recalls years like 1968 to me, and that is one of the focal points of Rocket Man, Robert Kirshen's latest, his fourth, sure to be a bestseller, and certainly a book that you should have in your bookshelves as well as his first three, Shadow Divers, Crashing Through, and Pirate Hunters. Getting the because this book is a very, I think, intimate portrait of these three men, now all of whom, I think, Lovell just turned 90.
Right.
I think one of the others, I think Borman is 90, and Bill Anders is like 85.
Right, correct.
Right. And I'm bad at math, too. Getting the cooperation. Lovell's been written about a lot. I mean, Lovell's a star.
Yes.
Because he's Tom Hanks.
Yes.
Everybody thinks he is Tom Hanks. Getting the cooperation, Rob, it's always an interesting kind of dance between subject and writer, isn't it?
Yeah, always.
Yeah.
It was it was very lucky for me that Jim Lovell is local, first of all.
Right, sure.
And he, just by good fortune for me, had been familiar with my book Shadow Divers. He'd read it.
Oh, fantastic.
And I think he enjoyed it. So when I approached him, he was familiar with me and was very welcoming to me. And once he and I sat down and connected and seemed to be on the same wavelength, then he made phone calls to the other two crewmen, to Frank Borman and Bill Anders.
Once he had ever time, I find that some people who were heroes at one point in their lives, many of them, are reluctant to wear that badge, reluctant to think of themselves as heroes. They're like, I was just doing my job. It was the right thing to do. There's no book in this. I did what I had to do, that kind of thing. Do these three men consider themselves heroic?
I think they would tell you they were just doing their jobs, that they all believed that it was important. The space race was important, and defeating the Soviet Union was important, and that if they weren't doing their jobs as astronauts, they would be fighting in Vietnam, serving their country. They're all patriots, and they believed in the cause. And to them, it was that simple. You know, they loved flying, so in many ways, the job was wonderfully interesting to them, but they believed they were doing their job, and I think they are very humble about what they were doing, and as I said before, really considered the people who were dying in Vietnam and serving the country to be the true heroes.
One of the hallmarks of that flight, as well as being the first one to get there, was the photo taken of Earth. It was the first kind of, with someone behind the camera, in essence, and it became, did it not, the whole sort of for the whole Earth movement became that photo, and I remember the photo because I've seen it 1,000 times since, and that was something. These three men became Time Magazine's Men of the Year. Was that a difficult decision for the magazine? You said before it was going to be the dissenter,
yes,
who would have been someone who looked much like the 17-year-old Rick Kogan on the cover of Time Magazine. Was that a tough decision for them? Or because it was, at the time, the biggest TV ratings in history.
Yes. For the broadcast they made on Christmas Eve as they orbited the moon, more people were listening to a human voice at a single time than ever had done so in history. Nearly a third of the world's population. I listened to them broadcast on Christmas Eve, and it was maybe the biggest moment in broadcast history at the time. And it had come just after they had seen the Earth rise. The photo you're describing is called Earthrise.
Right.
It remains 50 years later one of the most important and powerful and moving photographs ever taken.
Yeah.
And remember, of the many, many firsts that occurred on this trip, one of the firsts was human beings seeing the Earth for the first time as a full planet.
Right.
No one had ever seen
that
before.
Right. There are so many exciting things in Robert Curzon's book, Wreck-It Man, as you hear us both talking. I'm, in fact, going a little nutty here, too. Go to his website, Robert Curzon, KURSON.com. to order the book, pre-order the book, and the other books, too, I'm telling you folks, are every one of them is worth your time. You came, I sense, to like, not just to admire these three men, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders. You came to like them.
Very much so. I had heard before I met any of them that Jim Lovell was a very likable person.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you, I don't know that I've met a nicer, more genuine fellow than him in my life. He's not just nice for an astronaut. He's one of the warmest, most genuine guys you'd ever meet. And then you go meet Frank Borman and Bill Anders, and they're every bit the same as Lovell. They just could not be three nicer, more humble, ordinary, regular guys. And it's just a pleasure. You know, it's very dangerous to meet your heroes.
Sure.
And I've looked up to astronauts like many of us since I'm a little boy. And, you know, you and I both know what it's like to be disappointed by people we've admired. But this was the opposite. There could not have been kinder to me, more welcoming, and more accommodating. And just three really regular, nice guys.
And accomplished beyond what happened in Rocket Men. The final pages of the book are fascinating, where Frank Borman winds up pumping gas at a gas station. How did that happen?
Right, just a few
days. Hi, I'm the Time Man of the Year.
Right.
Fill it up, yeah.
Right, this is just another example of how regular these guys were.
Yep.
Just days after Apollo 8 returned from the moon, the first men ever to reach the moon, first men ever to leave Earth, he wanted to work on some cars with his son, so a local gas station owner let him use the garage there. And some guy came in and started pumping gas, and Borman was helping him pump gas, and the guy made a sarcastic remark, and pretty soon they're in a fist fight that one of Borman's big young sons had to break up. And the son told me that as he's breaking up this fight, he said, this guy does not know that he's fighting with the first man ever to go to the moon.
No, I know, and they wanted, Lovell was hit on by a lot of political people to maybe run for senator and run for political office. They all did well. Frank Borman wound up running Eastern Airlines. You remember the commercials for that. Lovell has had a fine career. Bill Anders, what did he wound up doing?
He ran General Dynamics.
Yeah.
Yeah, and became extraordinarily successful, and just a really brilliant business mind as well.
They have all read the book, no doubt.
Yes.
Did you ask them for feedback, or did you just send them the book and say, hope you enjoy?
No. I asked for not just feedback, but I demanded that they read this in advance. And I tell them what I told my other book subjects, that I'm not looking for editorial suggestions.
Right.
But I want to make sure that the book is bulletproof accurate, that every single thing I say in there is accurate to the best of all of our abilities. So
yeah.
I sat down with each of the three of them separately, and we went page by page through the book to make sure I hadn't made any mistakes.
Did you?
Yeah, there were some mistakes. There were. Some were my fault, some weren't.
Yeah.
You know, and some of it, you know, you read oral histories or other people's accounts, and it's 50 years ago, so people don't remember sometimes. But we worked them all out, and I'm very proud of that now.
Well, it's also amazing and fabulous that you could go to the primary. I mean, this is beyond the primary source for this stuff. These are the three men who were in the capsule that is in the Museum of Science and Industry. This is not like going to Google to find a fact. These are the real guys.
These are the real guys. And, you know, I would have, like, I worked with two world-class experts on Apollo who would also fact-check me, and one of them said, Borman turned this kind of handle when it was time to do this maneuver. And Borman himself would tell me, that's not what the handle looked like. And so, you know, you think, I'm going to go with the guy who was sitting next to the handle and trained for this mission.
I'm going to go with the guy who had the handle in his hand. That's why it's called the handle. Rob Kersen, all of your books, Shadow Divers, Crashing Through, Pirate Hunters, and now Rocket Man, is available for pre-sale. Easiest way to do that is to go to Robert Kersen, KURSON.com. I want you to nod your heads, family, Amy, Will, and Nate. Is he, does he lock himself up, and is he really crazy while he's in the midst of writing? They are all nodding. Well, okay, finally comes through. You got a great family, Rob. You've got an incredible bookshelf. I can't wait for the next one. And he started as a lawyer, and he found God, and now he's a best-selling nonfiction
Rick, I'm
writer.
A huge fan of yours, a long, long-time admirer, and I'm so honored and privileged to be here.
And he's also too nice. I mean, that's like almost... That's
I mean it from the bottom of my heart,
well,
I do.
Now, that's almost crazy nice. I know you do. Have a great time. As he said, there is a big, big to-do. The coolest book party. My mother, years ago, who worked for Doubleday, once had a party. Arthur Haley was in with his book Airport. And what did she do? And think of the goose that probably in the mid-50s or mid-60s. She hired an airplane to take a bunch of newspaper reporters up for a cocktail party in the air. That may have been the coolest book party. You don't do them like that anymore. You can get all this information at Rob's website, too, at the Museum of Science and Industry, on about which my father wrote the history many years ago of that lovely institution. Thursday night, Rob will be with those three astronauts, those three heroes, Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders. They'll do a panel discussion. There are tickets available.
Yes.
There are tickets available. They just opened it up for more tickets. Rob, it is great to see you. Congratulations. It's not my place to be proud of you, but I'm really proud.
Always great to see you. Thank you.
And if your family still likes you enough to come down here, I think that's the greatest testament to your career choice I've ever seen. We'll be back after the news with Floyd Sullivan to talk about his first novel, which is set in 1908 and features a lot of baseball. It's a fabulous book. Called out, a novel of baseball and America in 1908, which is, may not be quite as interesting as 1968, but it's an interesting, interesting year. We'll explore that, so stay tuned. I didn't know this, but I decided to play Joan Baez Sings Bob Dylan, not knowing that all of my guests would be of a similar vintage, where we'd say, oh my God, it's on the radio. It is my great pleasure to welcome in here Floyd Sullivan, who has written his first novel, and it is a winner, Called Out, a novel of baseball and America in 1908. Floyd, how are you?
Fine. Really nice to be here.
I am flabbergasted, and he's here with his lovely wife, Lucy, too. I am flabbergasted that the main protagonist in this fabulous, ambitious novel, a man named Harry Pulliam, he may have been the subject of some kind of fiction novel before, or may have been the subject of some kind of, nonfiction book. You bring this guy to life so vividly that I then went to research him apart. Research is real life. You do a remarkable job of breathing life into a fascinating guy. Why hasn't anybody done it before?
Well, thank you very much first.
You're very welcome. No, you're
I appreciate
very welcome.
The kind words. Back in 1908, he was written about a lot in the press.
Oh, yeah.
He was a very well-known figure in baseball circles at the time. But after the Fred Merkel play, which I guess we can chat about a little bit.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure.
And
well,
the controversy.
That seems to have been his, if not his Achilles heel, his sort of downfall, his the tragic element of his life.
That was the culmination of all the pressures he had been feeling over the course of several years, mostly from his enemies in the National League, specifically the New York Giants, John McGraw, manager, now in the Hall of Fame, yep. and the owner, John T. Brush, but also other team owners throughout the National League and a little bit in the American League, too. He was under a lot of pressure. It was not a fun time to be in baseball if you were a businessman or if you were other figures.
One of the things that really grabbed me about your book is the way in which you describe baseball and the not so much a specific game or anything, but the world of baseball in this era is so far apart from what it is today that it is hard to even imagine. You do a great job of filling it out, but tell the listeners how screwy baseball was in that time.
I think at one point in the book, I have one of the characters describe it as little better than a rat fight.
Yep.
And it was a boisterous, rough-and-tumble game. There was a lot of gambling, a lot of drinking. And the drinking wasn't just in the stands. It was the players themselves. And the gambling and the throwing of games was rampant. John McGraw especially epitomized baseball's struggle to come out of the 19th century and into the modern 20th century.
Yeah.
And he was a guy who would take any measure to win a game and to win a pennant. And, there are classic stories about him locking umpires out of the ballpark and stuff, where he had been in a fight with them the day before, and he had been complaining about the owner of the Pittsburgh Pirates, Mr. Dreyfus, and had been regaling him with anti-Semitic remarks and calling him a gambler, whereas, in fact, McGraw was a heavier gambler than Dreyfus ever could imagine being. But
one of the other things about your book, and again, it's called out, A Novel of Baseball and America in 1908, is America, too, is going through these kind of growing pains. America itself, in virtually every aspect of American life, is trying to grow up to fit itself into this 20th century.
Right. They were still getting used. The country was still getting used to the telephone.
Right.
Still getting used to electricity. Electricity was not 100% throughout society. It was changing from an agrarian to an urban society. In 1908, the year that this book is mostly set, General Motors was founded. The first Model T rolled off the assembly line in Detroit. The Wright brothers took their actual first real flight. They had the 1903 flights in Kitty Hawk,
yeah.
but they were very brief, 55, sure. 56 right. seconds or something like that. It wasn't until 1908 that they were able to demonstrate sustained flight of more than an hour and up to 90 minutes, and they were giving demonstrations to the American military and to the French military. And but still, nobody knew much about air travel at all at that time.
Yeah.
So all these things were happening at the same time. And
that's what makes this, I think, such a not only successful book, but ambitious to start with, Floyd Sullivan. When you sat down and said, I think I'm going to write a novel with baseball as an element of it, as a crucial element, as the guy, as my lead protagonist being a bigwig in baseball at the time, did you at that moment think to yourself, wow, there's all this other stuff I can incorporate, or was it a more organic?
It happened pretty gradually. I first became interested in the story of 1908 because I'm a Cub fan, and when I started writing this book 10 years ago or more, they hadn't won a World Series since 1908.
Yes.
And then Ken Burns had this documentary film in nine innings, as they called it back then, called Baseball. And the second episode featured a story about the Fred Merkle play of September 23rd. And it was such a crazy play. Still goes down in history, in baseball history, as one of the nuttiest plays ever. And I heard this, and it's 1994. I'm you know, 44 years old, and I'm thinking, I've been a Cub fan all my life, all my conscious life, and I've never heard this story.
The hard life for anybody. Yeah, it was a hard life.
It was. It's like, that's crazy. That's crazy. How come I never heard of this? And so I started looking into it.
And you're a trained historian. I mean, you have a degree in history,
right,
yes?
From Circle. Yeah. We called it Circle at the time. Now it's UIC.
I was there for a short time, too.
Yeah.
Maybe we saw it. They were still building the place when
I went
there.
Yeah, they sure were. There was a new building about every year.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah. No kidding. We got to take a break. We're going to spend the next half hour with Floyd Sullivan talking about Call Down, a novel of baseball in America in 1908. It is filled with compelling characters and a lot of compelling events. We'll tell you what the Fred Merkel thing is for those of you who don't know. It's about baseball and, as I would like to say, so much more. Baez singing the songs of her one-time boyfriend, Bob Dylan, from the late 60s era. I'm in here with Floyd Sullivan, whose novel is Called Out, a novel of baseball in America in 1908, published not long ago and available everywhere, like Amazon. Amica Press is the publisher. It's a great thing and a remarkable thing in this day and age to get a book published anywhere, as Floyd well knows. It is his first novel. It is terribly ambitious. It's set in Chicago and New York with a couple trips to Cincinnati, I think.
Pittsburgh.
It focuses on the National League president, a man named Harry Pulliam, who was a former newspaper man and a controversial figure. As we said before, I don't know if it's his downfall. One of the reasons I think he's been buried by history's dust is the Fred Merkel. I mean, I know the Fred Merkel to do. What was it, Floyd Sullivan?
In September of 1908, three teams were vying for the National League pennant. Actually, three teams were very close in the American League as well. It was one of the tightest races in both leagues, maybe in history. And the National League, it was the New York Giants, the Chicago Cubs, and the Pittsburgh Pirates. On September 23rd, the Cubs were within percentage points of the Giants, and we're talking about the last week of the race.
Yeah.
So they needed the game very badly. It was played at the Polo Grounds in New York City, and it went to the ninth and was a 1-1 tie in the bottom of the ninth with two out. There were men on first and third. The man on third was represented the winning run. The guy on first was a 19-year-old rookie.
He was the youngest kid on the team.
Yes,
right?
one of the youngest in the majors.
Yeah,
named Fred Merkel, and it was the first game he started that year. He was in because the normal first, their everyday first baseman, Fred Tenney, was sick.
Sick, drunk, who knows?
Anyway, so he actually got a hit that he thought should have been a double. But he ended up on first because they didn't want him to be thrown out as a third out of the inning at second base to end the inning. They had a legitimate scoring threat, and the runner on third would have won the game. So next batter gets up, Al Bridwell was his name, and he hits a clean single over Johnny Evers of the famous
Tinker to Evers, to Chance,
double play combination, goes into right field. Merkel takes off. Back then, they had takes off for second base. Back then, they had a tradition where if a team won the game on a walk-off, the fans were allowed to storm the field.
And that's an idea. That's not a good idea.
No. The clubhouse at the Polo Grounds was in center field. So this young Merkel ran about halfway to second base and saw these crazed fans thinking that their Giants were on the way to the pennant, stormed the field, running all over the place, looking for Cubs to hit. And so he took off halfway to second base. He took off for the clubhouse in center field.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Johnny Evers sees this, And the exact same thing had happened on September 4th in Pittsburgh. And it was Johnny Evers and the Cubs against the Pirates in a 10-inning game that was at a 0-0 tie. And the exact same thing. First baseman on first base, and he pulls up and takes off. Johnny Evers, in both cases, saw this and turned to center field and screamed for the ball. Throw me the ball, because as far as he was concerned, the ball was still live.
Right.
And if
right.
the guy didn't touch second base, he could be forced out. So in Pittsburgh, they did not allow the play, even though they got the ball in, because the umpire, a guy named Hank O'Day, who was from Chicago, by the way, and who's buried in Mount Carmel Cemetery, not far from Chuck Comiskey.
Jeez. So,
anyway, O'Day was the umpire in Pittsburgh, and he was the umpire in New York on September 23rd. Same guy. So Evers looks at him, and he walks up to the mound. Meanwhile, he turns to center field and screams at the center fielder, whose name was Circus Sally Hoffman, to throw the ball into him so they could force Merkel at second base.
Yeah.
Merkel did not run out.
He's running
to the clubhouse. So they throw the ball in. It was a bad throw. The third base coach for the Giants sees what they're doing, because by this time
sounds like such chaos.
It was out chaos.
There.
You have to imagine this: hundreds, if not thousands, of fans streaming all over the diamond, throwing things in the air, throwing
disco
bottles.
Demolition.
Absolutely,
yeah.
Much like that,
yeah.
Much like that. And so, meanwhile, Hank O'Day, who had been the umpire in Pittsburgh, is on the mound watching all this. The ball dribbles into the middle of the infield. This Giants coach picks up the ball. Two of the Cubs tackle him and fight him for the ball. He finally gets far enough away from these guys to throw it into the crowd to where no Cub can get to it. And meanwhile, a couple other Cubs see where it goes. And it went to a guy, a tall gentleman wearing a brown bowler hat. That's all they said about him. So this guy with the bowler then takes off, because now he sees three Cubs chasing after him. And he's got the game ball. He's got the live ball. And so he takes off. These three Cubs catch up to him and fight him for the ball, tackle him to the ground, but he won't give up the ball. So finally, one of the Cubs, a guy named Floyd, by the way, Floyd Crow, pounds his bowler over his eyes. And in his attempt to free his eyes, he drops the ball, and it goes rolling among all these running feet of the fans that had stormed the field. So Floyd Crow goes literally crawling after the ball. He finally gets the ball, stands up, throws it in to Joe Tinker, who then relays it to Johnny Evers, and they say, he's out. He's out. He's out. Meanwhile, the umps don't want to call the play right away. They go to the clubhouse. And Pulliam was at the game. And the Cubs and Pulliam want to know how they're going to rule.
Yeah.
So the other umpire at the game, Bob Emsley, asks Hank O'Day, did Merkel touch second base? And O'Day said, no, he did not. And they called him out. And that the game was declared a tie because they couldn't resume play because it was chaos and it was also getting dark. This was long before lights.
Sure.
And so they called it a tie. The Giants were as mad as they could be. The Cubs were mad.
Sure.
The Giants thought they won the game on the game winning hit by Al Bridwell, and the Cubs thought they should have won by forfeit. So now they're all putting all this pressure on Harry Pulliam, the president of the National League, to rule in this case. And what he did was he supported his umpires, which he did in Pittsburgh as well, which he was known to do. At that time, the president of the National League was responsible for the umpires, and he supported his umpires. And he said, they called Fred Merkel out. He's out. Game's a tie. If necessary. On the unlikely chance that the Cubs and the Giants are at the top of the National League with identical records, then we'll have a replay.
Right.
There's a replay game. So, as fate would have it, it's the last weekend of the season. The Cubs are in first place. The Giants need to sweep the Boston. They were called the Doves at the time. And they need to sweep them to tie the Cubs, and sweep them they did. So they ended up with identical records at the end of the year. They are, there are those who thought the Fix might have been in for that series.
Yeah, it sounded that way to me. Yeah.
So they ended up with identical records, and indeed they had to play that that game.
Wow.
And the pressure on Pulliam because of his decision was intense. It was intense from the teams, from the media, from everybody. The newspapers just pilloried him, and he was already under a lot of pressure for a lot of different things. He had fought with the Giants for years. Yeah. He had fought with John McGraw for years.
And McGraw seems like his great adversary.
Oh, yes.
Really bring that to the fore.
Yeah.
After the news, we'll talk a little bit more with Floyd Sullivan about Marshall Field and the Everly Club and about Ring Lardner. This book is packed with... If you just heard him talk about the Fred Merkel incident, you sense his passion for this era and this time and for this book. Was this a difficult book for you to write, Floyd? There's
yes.
so much in here. You were saying that Lucy, your bride, would do some research too, and you'd have, we got to get this in here, we got to get this in here. There's so much wonderful stuff packed into this book. Was it difficult at your first novel?
Well, I had written a novel before that almost got published, but it didn't. One of those stories.
Let's call it the first published
that's,
novel.
That's more accurate.
And
yeah.
you also write at, he blogs, I don't go to ChicagoNow.com as much as I should. It's a Tribune kind of enterprise, but he writes Waiting for the number 4 Cubs at ChicagoNow.com and is a very talented writer. But a novel's a different kettle of fish.
Sure.
I mean, was this difficult for you?
Yes, it was difficult in the sense that it took a lot of research, and I decided to write a historical novel as opposed to a historical account
yeah.
of that year because there are so many. There's, I think, at least 6 books about 1908.
Well, you make of Pulliam a fascinating character, and you make Ring Lardner and the Everly Club come to life too, which is which is no small thing. They have a night at the famous Everly Club. You also address the whole Marshall Field troubles at the Everly Club. It's a fine, fine, fine novel called out, A Novel of Baseball in America in 1908. We'll talk more with Floyd Sullivan after the news.
We carried you in our arms on Independence Day.
Welcome back. I have a few more minutes with Floyd Sullivan. We're talking about his first published novel, Called Out, A Novel of Baseball and America in 1908. It's wildly evocative of that time. Pulliam, the man who runs the National League, is with Ring Lardner, arguably the most famous sports writer ever. Pulliam asks, Ring Lardner made a phone call, and Pulliam asks, Mina? And Lardner says, Mina Everly, she and her sister Ada run the Everly Club. And this is some good writing after this flight. A line of carriages and hansoms stood waiting along Adams Street. The doorman motioned for the next in the queue. Pulliam climbed in ahead of Lardner. They drove along Michigan Avenue, a very dark grand park to their left, and the wall of tall office buildings, concert halls, private clubs, hotels, and a large automobile showroom to their right, bright warm lights spilling out of doorways and windows and onto the sidewalk and street. Those two gentlemen are going to the most famous brothel in the history of brothels called the Everly Club, run by Mina and Ada Everly, these enterprising sisters. It had to be a great deal of fun, some of this, to write about, you know, Ring Lardner Pulliam going there. You're a very inventive writer, Floyd, I must tell you, you really are. Because this kind of thing, historical novels can be dry. And yours is anything but. You throw in the whole story of Marshall Field, the second perhaps being killed at the Everly Club and having his body taken back to the home on Prairie Avenue to make it more respectable. Ring Lardner makes an appearance. You have Pinkerton detectives in this thing. What's been the response to the book? And this is obviously a labor of love. First, let me ask you how long it took you to write this.
I think about 10 years, although wow. my first interest was after that Ken Burns documentary, which was 1994.
Right.
So the research I put into it is much longer. But that was just because it was so fascinating.
Yeah,
but
you were into it as a former, you know,
history major.
Just
a fabulous story about that era, and specifically about baseball and the craziest year in baseball history, probably still to this date. So that, and then at some point, I had talked to a fellow Sabre member, Society for American Baseball Research, and I had co-authored a chapter in a book that he had written about Harry Pulliam's death. And he said that we should write a biography of Harry Pulliam. And so I started to do some research about Harry Pulliam specifically. And I contacted his family.
You got a hold of his granddaughter?
His Harry Pulliam's sister's granddaughter.
Gotcha.
And she didn't know anything. She didn't know if there were any papers anywhere. She didn't know if there was a diary anywhere. They had nothing of Harry Pulliam's
at all. Funny how history just fades away.
Yeah, and I actually contacted the Major League Baseball and asked them, do you have the, you know, like a banker box of records?
Yeah, sure, some archives. Yeah.
They had no idea what I was talking about.
Wow.
So it was kind of a dead end. So,
and then you must have gotten a little distracted at the Cubs' rush to the World Series.
Well, actually, by the time I had finished this book and started shopping it around, they still hadn't won the World Series.
Oh, okay. Because that would have destroyed that. That would have made it publication date in 2020 something.
Yeah. So, I got in touch with his, like I said, his sister's granddaughter, who didn't even know where Harry Pulliam's sister, her grandmother, was buried.
Wow.
And this is a very short story. I'd like to tell this. Just one of the nice things that can happen. She didn't know where it was. I had, during my research into Harry Pulliam himself, I had located his grave and his grave marker. It's a big obelisk, kind of heavy obelisk in Cave Hill Cemetery in Louisville. And so I went back online and I found a high definition photograph of that.
Wow.
And I saw that his name was on there, but also Grace Pulliam Kane. That was his sister. Huh. So I emailed back to his sister's granddaughter, and I said, look, your grandmother is buried in Louisville at this cemetery, at this place. And she was so grateful. She said, I know where my grandfather is, but my grandmother isn't buried with him, and I don't know where she is. And now I do. So
that's
I'm so grateful.
Nice of you.
And they were about to take a trip to the east. She lives in Washington State.
Your professors at Circle Campus would be very proud of you.
Right.
The other thing, again, the book is called Called Out, A Novel of Baseball in America in 1908. It's perfect reading as the baseball season begins, as is Floyd Sullivan's blog at chicagonow.com. It's called Waiting, the Number 4 Cubs. He had a very interesting piece in there. Maybe it's not the most recent one, but one about Ernie Banks' new gravesite in Graceland Cemetery. I hate that thing. I don't think it does him. It's ugly, and you sort of share that opinion. Floyd, I cannot tell you how much I enjoyed this and how
glad to hear it. Thank you,
and I hope there are more.
There will be.
Good.
Yeah, and thank you very much for having me.
The long-suffering Lucy. Your wife is a troop. The wife of all novelists deserves some kind of award all their own. Floyd, I'll see you soon. Thanks a million.
All right.
We'll take a commercial break and come back and talk to Stephen Altup of the Apollo Chorus. We'll be right back. Once again, that is the last time you will be hearing tonight the voice of Joan Baez singing the songs of her former boyfriend, Bob Dylan, from a CD, a wonderful CD called Baez Sings Dylan. I have to ask my next guest, Stephen Altup, who runs the fabulous Apollo Chorus of Chicago. Stephen, wouldn't you like to have Joan Baez's voice as part of the chorus? Wouldn't that be a nice thing?
Absolutely, especially when we do our first ever all Joan Baez concert.
Stephen, it's great to talk to you. Stephen and I have done radio shows together for a very long time because I'm a huge fan of the Apollo Chorus of Chicago. which is was formed in 1872, just post-fire, and which has a couple of unbelievably cool events coming up. I know the Poetry Foundation event is kind of a smaller kind of thing in advance of April 13th's Nichols Concert Hall bash in Evanston. This is, Stephen, relatively unusual for the Apollo Chorus to be performing with poetry and music by a guy named Jeff Beal and poetry by the Pulitzer Prize-winning Kay Ryan. This seems really ambitious.
Well, what's not unusual, I'm happy to say, is a collaboration with a great Chicago organization, which the Poetry Foundation certainly is. But you could not be more correct that this is a very unique happening in that we have Jeff Beal, the composer of the Netflix series House of Cards, coming. And we really enjoyed collaborating with him last year. It was the success of that that sort of led to these events. And Jeff wrote, you know, he's very well known for his TV and film scores. He's one of the best out there. But this work that we're doing, the main work we're doing, is a very serious, moving, beautiful a cappella or unaccompanied choral work. And four of the five poems are by Kay Ryan, who's a former poet laureate of the United States.
And a Pulitzer Prize winner, too.
How
did this come to be, Stephen Alltop? I know that you, the great member of the chorus, Arlene Carlucci, has told me that you went to, you and Jeff Beal were college classmates, yes?
We were students together at the Eastman School of Music, and, you know, they're working with aspirations for the future, and Jeff was one of the most hardworking students I knew at that time when we were good friends. And we went our separate ways. This basically came about in a way that many people can relate to. I was watching House of Cards. I usually get around to these TV series about 5 years after everybody
same
else.
Same here.
Yeah. And I thought, wow, this opening music is just really good. It's much better than the norm.
Sure.
So I checked out who the composer was. It's like, hey, it's Jeff. So I sent him an email and just said, I'm so happy for your success. And I think it was 2 days later, I'm getting this San Bernardino area code number on my phone. It's like, wait, who's this? And it was Jeff. And we just reconnected after, I won't say how many years. And
you started plotting too then, right?
Yeah, we started plotting live performances. And this will be, I think, the fourth event that we will have done since that conversation about 2.5 years ago.
What did he think? Was he equally impressed by the arc of your career? Because I think what you've done with the Apollo Chorus over the last, man, it's got to be like 15 years now, isn't it, Stephen?
Oh, well, longer? 21.
Oh, yeah. My.
The years fly.
Wow, they sure do. They sure do.
Well, I mean, Jeff, I'm a humble conductor, and Jeff is a big international TV film star. But I guess the one thing that really attracted Jeff is that what he missed was the concert stage.
Yeah.
His music was being heard by millions, but, you know, he's a performer at heart. So what people will have a chance to do is to not only meet him and hear him talk and hear about the genesis of this piece, which came about right after Jeff was diagnosed with MS.
Oh, my
God. Which is
God.
Sort of it's a big part of what he's dealt with in his life and
sure.
dealt with very successfully. But also he's going to be playing the flugelhorn, which is, you know, sort of jazz aficionados will know that's a type of trumpet.
Right.
And he'll be performing on one of his other short jazz-inspired works with the chorus, just Jeff on flugelhorn and the chorus. And it's just an amazing opportunity that's coming up. It's next weekend.
I don't want to push too hard, but there may be room at the April 12th at 7 p.m. at the Poetry Foundation, which is one of the great buildings and, I think, performance spaces in Chicago. April 13th at 7:30 at Nichols Concert Hall in Evanston. And Stephen Alltop, you and I have talked about Nichols Concert Hall. I think it's a gem of not just the Midwest. It's one of the concert gems of this entire country.
I couldn't agree more. And this whole event will be perfectly cast there. Just the size of the space, the acoustics. I keep saying to people that the more I think about this, it's just one of those events where you can't anticipate all the wonder of it until you're there, I think. But the people who are there, I think, will get so much out of it.
Stephen, now, how did the poems of Kay Ryan, because I do believe she's going to be there too, is she not?
She's going to be there and reading the poems and talking with Jeff and myself about how these came together. Well, of the five movements of this piece that Jeff wrote called The Salvage Men, mm-hmm. that is one of her poems. It happens to be the last movement of the work. Well, the first one is based on a poem by Oscar Wilde. And then the next four are all by Kay Ryan. And it's just a great example of when words and music come together.
Yeah.
That the combined power of the two is just fantastic.
Wow. How many members of the, I know that the Apollo Chorus has something like 120, 125, it varies a little bit. How many members of the chorus will be involved in the production at Nichols Concert Hall?
We'll have about 60 members of the chorus, so about half the chorus, which will be the right number for that stage.
And how have they taken to this, sort of the you expanding the repertoire of the chorus? I bet they've taken to it quite well.
I think that they have worked extremely hard, and we have all realized gratification, just in spades from these experiences. I will tell you that when we started Jeff's piece, The Salvage Men, it was challenging. And it was one of those great examples of how you cannot judge something until you've really completely absorbed it. And by the time we performed it, I think many chorus members would agree with me that it was one of the most moving things we've ever done, which we did last May, and look forward to doing again on April 12th and 13th.
Well, again, it's April 12th at 7 p.m. at the Poetry Foundation. And if you've never been to the Poetry Foundation, it is worth a visit on any day, but especially for this. That is going to be a more conversational, is it not, Stephen, as opposed to a concert on April 13th at Nichols Concert Hall in Evanston? So ideally, one listening now should participate in both events.
They'll both have very similar content. April 12th at the Poetry Foundation will be a little more intimate. The April 13th will be the fuller version of the two programs. And the Poetry Foundation has a great website, so people can get all of this information under their events on their website. And I don't even know how many people know that the Poetry Foundation has its international headquarters here, but what a great resource to city.
Don't you also think it's a spectacular building?
It is. Yeah. I mean, they're so fortunate to have it, and I've had the privilege of performing in their recital space a couple of times, and we're just so excited to take this program and these great artists into that space.
Stephen, if you could, before I let you go and go to sleep, and thank you again for being available. It's so great to talk to you again. We'll have to do it at length soon. But give me a state of the Apollo Chorus these days. You've been there for 21 years. I find it, there's always, to my mind, something new and exciting coming around. I mean, you were sort of spreading the wings of the chorus, are you not?
Yes. It might surprise a lot of people to know that when it comes to presenting music and composers of our time, the Apollo Chorus is one of the most active choral ensembles in Chicago. In fact, our next program will combine, we like to combine new and old and give people, experiences they love and experiences that are new and challenging and delightful. So in May, we'll be doing Carmina Burana, which people love.
Sure.
But we'll also be doing six works by Midwestern composers from Iowa and Minnesota and Illinois and, the states that surround us.
And you're still getting, when you make calls for auditions, Chicago is not lacking in interested voices, are they?
No, it's really a magnet for people coming out of great choral programs who want to continue that experience, experiences they had in college, let's say. And so that has been a great thing to see happen with the Apollo Chorus. But I guess to answer your question succinctly, I think this season really represents the fact that the chorus is enjoying one of the best schedules, I think, of any chorus in the country, just with the variety of repertoire that we are getting to do. It's really exciting.
It sounds like it to me. So before I let you go, Apollo After Hours, which takes place on April 20th at a great, relatively new, I wrote about the Underground Place when it opened in Uptown. What's that, Stephen Althoff?
This is one of the chorus's major fundraisers, and it's just a heck of a lot of fun. We get together, there's great food, and then performers from within the chorus itself do basically cabaret numbers, which don't normally figure into the chorus's programming for the season. But this is their chance to do small group solos, and it's just a lot of fun, and it helps raise money for the chorus.
Has this been an annual event, Apollo After Hours?
Or is this like it's been going on about a decade or
so. Yeah. Stephen, you sound great, and you continue to do amazing work with the Apollo Chorus. Again, I have to thank Arlene Carlucci for putting us together. Go to musicinst.org. You'll get all the information about the April 13th concert at Nichols Concert Hall, which really is an astonishing venue, and April Poetry, I think it's poetryfoundation.org, I think. What's your website? What Apollo Chorus?
ApolloChorus.org, and all the information is there as well. And as always, we so appreciate what you do for the arts here in this town.
Oh, God, my pleasure. I miss seeing you, though. I miss seeing you. We'll have to get together at length and talk about the Apollo Chorus. And it's an astonishing jewel in Chicago's cultural box of cultural goodies. I'll put it that way.
Well, let's make a date for 4 years from now when we're celebrating our 150th anniversary.
I'll do it before that, Stephen. Thank you so much. It's great to talk to you again.
You too. Thanks so much.
My pleasure. Anytime. Once again, the information is go to poetryfoundation.org, or you can go to apollochorus.org, or go to, just look up. You guys can figure this out. It's MusicInst, I-N-S-T, musicinst.org. For all the information, April 12th at the Poetry Foundation, which is right downtown at Dearborn and Superior Street, an amazing, amazing building. Oh, and Ben Anderson, who's been filling in admirably and spectacularly for Lise Graham, who's out for a while, is going to have that all on the website. So I don't have to tell you, he's going to have also all the information about Rob Kersen and his latest book, Rocket Men, The Daring Odyssey of Apollo 8 and the Astronauts Who Made Man's First Journey to the Moon. Just a fabulous book. And because Ben is so good, and because I have two copies of this book, and because he told me he flies airplanes, which is, I'm not sure there's ever been a producer here who's like also a pilot, I'm going to give him a copy of Rob's book. Then Floyd Sullivan was in here talking enthusiastically. He'd be a great, Rob Kersen would be fantastic at any library doing an event. He's probably booked up like crazy because he is a best-selling author. Floyd Sullivan would also be fabulous for any of you out there who run a library and think, wow, we need someone to speak at our library. Plus, it's baseball season, ladies and gentlemen. It is baseball season. So, I appreciate, as ever, Aubrey Mumpower's skill engineering this show. Ben Anderson does everything. When I came in tonight, he goes, well, I've almost got the podcast done. And I go, well, what's on it? It would just be a bunch of empty dead air. We haven't even done the show yet. I know what he means. He's posting it all up so you people can avail yourselves of it at what might be a more convenient time for you. All of you, thank you for listening. Thanks to Roger Badish for doing the news and just being a pal. Carl Amari is coming up, and I am going home. It's freezing out, too. This is the most ridiculous spring I can remember, and I've lived a lot of springs here.